Greetings. According to Tongu Rinpoche, a highly realized master of the Tibetan Kagyu lineage of Buddhism, there are only two outcomes to any situation, positive or negative, neither of which is due to random chance. Of course, when bad stuff happens, we have a vague kind of sense that fate or the universe is working against us, and we cry out to friends or even just to ourselves, "Why me?" and become miserable or depressed. But when life is swimming along nicely, we tend to think that is how it should be, now and always. Of course, life teaches us constantly that both good and bad happens, and we don't know when the one will morph into the other. From a Buddhist perspective, the kind of attitude that expects everything to work out the way we want comes from the foggy mind of ignorance, the mind that refuses or is unable to see how things really work. Which is not surprising. Most of us don't care to acknowledge the pervasive nature of cause and effect, and vaguely think chance or luck has some part to play in how life works out. But nothing comes from chance or luck, and as Tongu Rinpoche points out, if bad things happen, we should not blame anyone else. It is our own misfortune coming from our own karma. Once we realize this, the best we can do, he says, is to clear up all non-virtuous karma and pray that it may not happen to other beings as well. And how should we approach life when good stuff comes our way? Well, then it's very easy to become complacent and develop an "I'm okay, Jack" attitude, happy that we're not like those poor sods who are not having such a good time. Like those Russian rich kids we spoke about last week, who drove around St. Petersburg throwing money out of the window of their car and shouting things like, "Ha ha, take hundreds of dollars, you little people." Tongu Rinpoche advises that we actually do the opposite. Wish that such happiness happens to everybody else as well, and turn whatever good happens to us, such as wealth, power, or influence, to positive use. He says in his commentary to the 7-point mind training, "If things were always pleasant and we were successful and experienced good circumstances, it's quite likely that we would become too attached to that and expect that everything would be fine. Because of being too fond of having a good time and enjoying ourselves, it's quite likely that we should forget about our concern for other beings and become insensitive. If things always go wrong and we continuously have problems, it's quite likely that we will get caught up in that and worry about ourselves too much." So what is the advice for dealing with things, whether good or bad? Well, the answer to that is what we've been discussing over the last couple of weeks as we've gone through Namkapel's mind training like the rays of the sun. If you were with us last week, you will remember we were discussing the slogan, "Whichever occurs, be patient with both." And this is what Tongu Rinpoche is talking about in the quotes above. He translates the slogan as, "Whichever of the two occurs, be patient." And the two he is referring to are good times and bad times. Whether times are difficult or times are easy, we are told to be patient. In other words, to realize that all things pass. Whatever is happening now will in due course change, and to keep our minds equanimous and calm. No need to jump with joy when fate seems to shower us with all life's blessings, and no need to sink into deep depression where it seems curses are what we're being anointed with. Just be patient with both. In fact, we can go one better than just being patient. We can use either situation to our own advantage by turning our mind to the suffering and joy of others with practices like Tonglen. You may remember that in Tonglen, which means taking and giving, we take on others' suffering with our own and give them our happiness with a free heart. This is one way of making positive use of our experiences, whatever they are. Okay, so that's a kind of introduction to where we're at with mind training like the rays of the sun. And now, before going further, let's think about motivation as we usually do. Please try to summon up a bodhicitta motivation for the program today. In other words, that it may be a cause for us to all to attain enlightenment for the benefit of all those who can and those who can't themselves reach enlightenment in the near future. But not only do we want to help them just to become enlightened, We should be thinking that whatever we can do to alleviate their discomfort and dis-ease, that we will do as quickly as possible. So let's take a short break to think about motivation. Thank you. So now, having discussed at some length the slogan, whichever occurs, be patient with both, I think it must be time to move on to the next one under the heading, the precepts of mind training, and that is, guard both at the cost of your life. Lamkarpel says, the pledges or natural commitments of the three vows you've taken, and in particular the commitments of mind training explained above, should be guarded at the cost of your life. Now let's go a little further than that with how Trungpa Rinpoche explains it. Translated as, maintain these two even at the risk of your life, he says, there is a phrase in Tibetan which is, higher than you would your own life. Is there anything we hold more dear than our life? When it is lost, we cannot continue, so it's most precious to us. Yet for a practitioner of mind training, there's something more precious, and that is what to adopt and what to avoid. This means we should adopt what is virtuous and avoid what is non-virtuous. We should realize that discriminating between what is good and what is evil is actually more important than our own life. Now imagine being a Buddhist monk or nun living in a monastery in Mongolia when the Russian communists invaded the country. Communist soldiers arrive at your monastery and demand that you either violate your vows, like get married, or you will be killed. What would you do? Now, I cannot say that I would not give in to the demands, and as I understand it, many monks did get married in that situation. After the Russians pulled out of the country, His Holiness the Dalai Lama told the monks they would have to choose whether to disrobe, to stay in their marriage, or to leave the marriage and become celibate again. Now, it's easy to see that this life is short, and violating the precepts will cause much long-term suffering in the future. But still, it's not easy to give up one's life, even for the sake of keeping the precepts. Nevertheless, this is what the slogan is saying we should train our mind to do. Let's see what Chogyam Trungpa and his disciple, the nun Pema Chodron, have to say about the slogan. They translated as, observe these two, even at the risk of your life. And in training the mind and cultivating loving-kindness, Chogyam Trungpa gives quite a pithy teaching on it. He says, you should maintain the disciplines you have committed yourself to, in particular, the refuge vow and the bodhisattva vow. You should maintain the general attitude of being a decent Buddhist, and beyond that, the special discipline of lojong, or mind training. Pema Chodron, meantime, has this to say in Start Where You Are, A Guide to Compassionate Living. Now it's time for us to continue our journey and walk it like we talk it. One of the final slogans is, observe these two even at the risk of your life. It refers once again to the refuge and bodhisattva vows. It has a sense of urgency, even at the risk of your life. That's telling us not to be afraid to leave the nest. Don't be afraid of losing ground or of things falling apart or of not having it all together. The meaning of observing the essence of the refuge vow, even at the risk of your life, is no escape, no problem. To observe the bodhisattva vow is to exchange ourselves for others and develop compassion for ourselves and others. So even at the risk of our own lives, if it's painful, breathe it in and think about all of the other people who are experiencing pain. If it's delightful, give it away and wish for all people to have that delight. That's the essence of the slogan. It's a revolutionary idea. Here is one last story about exchanging self for others. I met a young man who had been on a spiritual journey most of his life. He was awake but smug. He suffered from what's called spiritual pride. He was complaining about his girlfriend, who was having a hard time giving up smoking. The anxiety was triggering an old eating disorder. The young man said he just kept telling her to be strong, not to be so fearful, to be disciplined. And she would tell him, I'm trying, I'm really trying, I'm doing the best I can. He was angry because it didn't seem to him that she was trying. He said, I know I shouldn't be getting so angry about this. I know I should be more compassionate. But I just can't help it. It gets under my skin. I want to be more understanding, but she's so stuck. Then he heard himself say, I'm trying. I'm really trying. I'm doing the best I can. When he heard himself saying her words, he got the message. He understood what she was up against, and it humbled him. Pema Chodron goes on, I think that all of us are like eagles who have forgotten that we know how to fly. The teachings are reminding us who we are and what we can do. They help us notice that we're in a nest with a lot of old food and old diaries, excrement and stale air. From when we were very young, we've had this longing to see those mountains in the distance and experience that big sky and the vast ocean. But somehow we got trapped in that nest just because we forgot that we knew how to fly. We are like eagles, but we have on underwear and pants and shirt and socks and shoes and a hat and coat and boots and mittens and a Walkman and dark glasses. And it occurs to us that we could experience that vast sky, but we'd better start taking off some of this stuff. So we take off the coat and the hat, and it's cold, but we know that we have to do it. And we teeter on the edge of the nest, and we take off. Then we find out for ourselves that everything has to go. You just can't fly when you're wearing socks and shoes and coats and pants and underwear. Everything has to go. That's Pema Chodron. So perhaps if everything has to go for us really to get it, our life has to be expendable also. Pema Chodron is suggesting here that we cannot cling on to anything, and we should be ready even to give up our life and everything that we take on to make it valuable. In the foothills of the Himalayas in Rishikesh, I heard a story about George Gurdjieff that may illustrate this. Gurdjieff was known as a crazy wisdom master, one who would do outlandish things and make his followers do increasingly outlandish things to give themselves up. Anyway, at one time, Gurdjieff said to a group of his students that they had to do exactly what he told them, and then he set them to meditate at designated places outside his house as a big storm was approaching. They were not to move, no matter what. So the storm arrived and caused a flood. As the waters arose and started to engulf them, one by one the students gave up and rushed off to safety, until only two were left. Even when the water rose up and started to cover their heads, they didn't move. But when it totally covered them, one of the students could take it no longer and swam for safety. The other refused to move, thinking that even if he was to die, he would not go against the advice of his guru. And then when he'd given up absolutely everything, Gurdjieff came out of his house and pulled the student out of the water. The way I heard the story, that student admitted later that the experience was invaluable and he was completely transformed by it. So although the slogan and some of the explanations may appear to be quite dry, they might be pointing to something transformative if we can manage to be prepared to give up our life for our commitments. And we don't have to do it all in one day. As we practice the teachings, if we give them time, they will take hold in their own time, and then we too can in due course become like that student who would give everything, including his life, for the transformation the teachings will bring. But if we are still at the stage of being frightened by the rising waters, not yet ready to give all up, perhaps we should retreat to safety until we have the courage to stay. Pema Chodron talks a bit about this in the follow-on to her commentary. She uses the teacher of the great Tibetan yogi Milarepa as an example. This teacher's name was Marpa, and Pema Chodron says this about him. He walked all the way from Tibet to India three times in order to get the teachings. Once when he was returning from India, he was with a companion whom he met every so often to compare who was getting the most teachings. His companion became jealous because he felt that Marpa was getting more. When they were in a boat in the middle of a turbulent river, his friend took all of the texts that Marpa had collected and threw them overboard. Talk about an opportunity for Tonglen. Marpa didn't exactly feel friendly towards this man. But he realized when he got back to Tibet that he had understood something about all of those teachings in all of those books. He really didn't need it all written down. He had understood something. He had digested something. The teachings in himself had become one. Each of us has also understood something, and that's what we'll take away from our study and practice of these teachings. These are the things that are going to be part of our being now, part of the way that we see things and hear things and smell things. We try so hard to hang on to the teachings and get it, but actually the truth sinks in like rain into very hard earth. The rain is very gentle, and we soften up slowly at our own speed. But when that happens, something has fundamentally changed within us. That hard earth has softened. It doesn't seem to happen by trying to get it or capture it. It happens by letting go. It happens by relaxing your mind. And it happens by the aspiration, the longing to want to communicate with yourself and others. Each of us finds our own way. And that again is Pema Chodron. I think this is what it means to practice the mind training teachings. At first, when we start, it seems hard to think that we should give up our life for them. It's impossible. But as we practice and slowly over time realize the benefits and the teachings become part of us, it may become impossible not to give up our lives for something that has become so fundamental and which we realize is so beneficial to our whole journey, not just this little part of it. Perhaps this understanding and compassion for ourselves is in the end what is needed for this slogan to really make sense to us. Otherwise, saying we will give up our life for the sake of the precepts might just be wishful thinking. When the soldiers come for us, will we really be ready to do like Giles Corey in Arthur Miller's play The Crucible, who stood by his principles even while great stones were placed on his body until he died? When Proctor asks his wife how Corey died, she says, "He were not hanged. He would not answer aye or nay to his indictment. For if he denied the charge, they'd hang him surely and auction out his property. So he stand mute and died Christian under the law." Proctor says, not looking at her, "Then how does he die?" Elizabeth says gently, "They press him, John." And Proctor, now looking at her, asks, "Press?" Elizabeth explains, "Great stones they lay upon his chest until he plead aye or nay. They say he give them but two words. More weight, he says, and died." Now let's look at what another commentator, B. Alan Wallace, has to say about the slogan in his book, The 7-Point Mind Training. His take on the slogan is, "Guard the two at the cost of your life." And he says, "The two referred to here are, first, any precepts we've taken on ourselves in general in our Dharma practice, and second, the specific pledges, precepts and practices of this mind training. Guard these," Geshe Chikawa says, "even at the cost of our life." This is a demanding statement and very earnestly meant. There are some things more precious than one's life. Several lamas have commented to me that there is no value in a long life if it is dominated by unwholesome actions of body, speech, and mind. Obviously, in such a life, one is simply polluting one's stream of consciousness, sowing seeds year after year for the repercussions of further suffering and misery. What is it that brings value and benefit to the very core of a life? It is our Dharma practice. Rather than sacrifice our spiritual practice, it is better to sacrifice a life. On the website www.luminouswisdom.org, the Nyingma teacher Kempo Tsultrum Lodro has this to say about the importance of practice. "Without practice or mind training, we cannot be sure of attaining liberation. For instance, over the several decades in our lifetime, we do not in general have to worry about our livelihood. As long as we are willing to work, it is more or less guaranteed. However, death, this uninvited guest, comes when we least expect it. At the critical moment, we're not at all prepared to confront death or transform it into the path. Invariably, we are helpless when death arrives. So the question of birth, aging, illness, and death is a more important one than existence. If we cannot address this problem properly, it is more frightening than the struggle to stay alive. If we can come to terms with the problem in the correct way, it will be more meaningful than solving our livelihood. Therefore, practice is extremely important. Before the practice, we must first have the corresponding view. Without right understanding, how do we practice? If we're not even clear about the direction, there's no point in talking about the practice. A lot of people will say, we want practice, not listening and contemplation. Although practice is imperative in the end, so too are listening and contemplation up front. We can practice only after we've given sufficient time to listening and contemplation, that is, after these activities have reached a certain level. What does reaching a certain level mean? By this we mean it is impractical to receive teachings on all of the 84,000 Dharma methods. However, at the very least, we should understand the method we are practicing, why it is practiced this way, and what the final outcome is. To achieve this understanding, we must first spend an appropriate amount of time to listen and reflect on the Dharma. Regrettably, ordinary people have inverted values. Everyone thinks the ultimate goal in life is to make money and live well. The question of life and death, on the other hand, can be brushed off. In reality, even though our livelihood is an important matter, practice is even more important. Mind training is essential to everyone, including me. Like all of you, I still have afflictions and continue to wander in samsara. Since we have obtained precious human rebirth in this lifetime, we should cherish the opportunity to practice. If we forego this chance, I fear that we are giving up on an opportunity that comes just once in many kalpas. Of course, I cannot say we will not get another opportunity, but just when this opportunity will arrive is difficult to say. Perhaps one lifetime, perhaps 100 lifetimes, possibly even 1 or 10,000 lifetimes, which is a very distant matter. Not only that, can we be clear-headed enough by then to seize the opportunity? We may, as in this lifetime, idle away our time in ignorance, waste our precious birth, and once again miss a great chance. That would be the same as having no opportunity at all. There are some people now that are really pitiful. Short-sighted and simple-minded, they are contented with their current lot, think they have everything they deserve, and do not feel it necessary to practice. This is a deluded way of thinking, since such a person cannot look beyond the present. Although they have everything they want now, good health, a successful career, and a happy family, who can guarantee these things will last? No one can give this assurance, not in this life, let alone the next. Thus, even with power and wealth, we need to practice. Conversely, some people from low-income families will question how they can find time to practice and study the teachings when their livelihood is still an issue that has to be resolved. For them, it's wait and see. This viewpoint is also incorrect. If we lack for food, we can borrow money or even beg to get something to eat. Whatever the situation, there's always a way. However, on a major issue such as birth, aging, illness, and death, we cannot borrow money or beg for help. Without prior practice, there is nothing that can be done. Thus, even the poor have to practice. To summarize, whether we choose to practice or not, it is essential to all of us regardless of our background. Our focus hereon is the practice, not burning incense, prostrating to the Buddhas, or reciting the sutras. If we read the Diamond Sutra in the morning and Kasatigarbha Sutra in the evening, this constitutes recitation, not practice. Although reciting the sutras can contribute to the accumulation of merit and help the practice, it is not true practice. What constitutes a true practice? It is contemplation on precious human birth, impermanence of life, and the other preliminaries. He then goes on to say that three trainings are vital: the trainings in renunciation, bodhicitta, and the realization of emptiness of self. We must try our utmost to cultivate these three qualities of mind, he says. If at the end of our lives we do not have renunciation and bodhicitta, nor realization of emptiness, and moreover cannot obtain a favorable rebirth in the three higher realms, The consequence of falling into the unfavorable realms is unthinkable. We know that the animal realm is the preferred rebirth among the three lower realms. However, a key point is that animals are extremely ignorant and incapable of any kind of practice. Not only that, they cannot distinguish between good and evil, are just as afflicted by desire, anger, and delusion, and repeatedly commit unwholesome actions. Thus, taking rebirth as an animal will create even more bad karma, the result of which is one may never again return as a human being. Due to the great importance of practice, we must be diligent. In this lifetime, we must at least develop genuine renunciation and bodhicitta. With renunciation and bodhicitta as a basis, we can quickly realize emptiness. Even without realization, genuine bodhicitta will lead to a better future life, give us greater certainty in the practice, and bring us closer to liberation. Although we are now blessed as human beings, how much time do we have left in this life? No one knows. Perhaps a few years, 10+ years, or several decades. When our blessings accumulated from past years are exhausted, our situation will change for the worse. This is not the Creator's doing, nor does it happen without reason. 'Tis the natural law of cause and effect. In the face of this natural law, there is little one can do. However, with effort, one can alter the direction it takes. It's like cultivating land. Under ordinary circumstances, when a seed is planted, it grows into a crop. But whether it can grow into a crop or a certain kind of crop depends on other conditions. A seed will not grow if the conditions are either incomplete or unfavorable. Although a cause produces an effect in general, there may not be a result if conditions change radically during the developmental process. What we hope to do now is change the rules governing samsara. To do that, we need to undertake practice, specifically the practices that lead to renunciation, bodhicitta, and the realization of emptiness. After training these three practices, we can say, although I've committed a lot of bad karma in this life, I have trained in these sacred practices and have not wasted this precious birth, so my life is meaningful. Conversely, if we've not trained in these practices and have only attained worldly fame, wealth, and so forth, this kind of life would be meaningless. The only thing of value we can bring with us is our practice. Only our realization from practice is dependable. It will never lie to us. And with that, we should say farewell as our time is now up. Thanks for joining the program, and I hope you'll do so again next week. Please dedicate all the positive potential to gaining enlightenment for the sake of all beings. Thank you, and goodbye.